Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Ruben Garcia, founder and executive director of Annunciation House on the El Paso-Juarez border. He'll speak on the topic Welcoming the Stranger, Immigrant Hospitality at the Border, and Creighton. Mr. Garcia's talk was co-sponsored by several Creighton University areas and organizations, including the School of Law, the College of Business, the Graff Faculty Chair in Catholic Theological Studies, Campus Ministry, the Cortina Community, and the Creighton Center for Service and Justice. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 10, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, the sponsoring organizations, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Maria Teresa Gaston, director of the Creighton Center for Service and Justice.
Ruben Garcia is a native of the border, born and raised in El Paso, Texas. Jesuit educated, he went to El Paso Jesuit High School, then went to Rockhurst in Kansas City, Missouri, and Seattle in Seattle, Washington, Seattle U. From 70 to 78, he served as the director of Youth and Young Adult Ministry, the Department of the Catholic Diocese of El Paso. And in 1978, Ruben, along with four other individuals, founded Annunciation House, with whom he has been, the house that he has served ever since, serving as its director. In response to the great need for pro bono legal services brought about by the tremendous flow of refugees from El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Honduras, navigating the El Paso Juarez corridor in the early 80s, Annunciation House helped initiate the process that led to the establishment of Las Americas Refugee Asylum Project. Ruben served as the first president of the board. For almost 33 years, the houses of hospitality operated by Annunciation House on the U.S.-Mexican border in El Paso, Texas, have provided hospitality to over 110,000 immigrants, refugees, and undocumented persons from Mexico, Central America, and 40 other countries. We welcome you, Ruben Garcia, tonight. Founders Week. Thank you.
Gracias, Maria Teresa. It's a delight to be here with you. Thank you for the invitation to join you. I'd like to begin by sharing with you a story that we experienced there on the border 2 years ago. There was a woman from El Salvador that crossed the river in the middle of the night. She had a coyote, and the coyote helped her cross from Juarez into El Paso. Once she was on the El Paso side of the border, the coyote deserted her. And so he said to her, "I want you to wait for me here. I will be back for you." He didn't come back, and she was standing there, wet from having crossed the river, cold, and when the sun rose, she began to walk, realizing he's not going to come back. And so she started walking and walking, and little by little, she made her way to where there was more traffic, and then she started asking, "Is there a church someplace?" And someone would say, "Well, walk down this way." And someone says, "Well, look, you know, I think the nearest church is still pretty far. Here's some money for the bus." She got on the bus. She got off the bus, started walking again. And eventually, she found herself making her way. It was a weekday, Tuesday or Thursday, I can't remember, to San Antonio de Padua Catholic Church. It so happened that there in that parish, there was a group of elderly women that had this ministry where they gave out food baskets to families, many of them undocumented families. They would give food baskets and some clothing to people. It was something that was pretty well organized. They would gather there in the morning. They would go to Mass. After Mass, they would go over to where they had their food. They would put the food baskets together, and then families would start arriving at about 10 o'clock, and they would share the food baskets with them. This woman, her name was Morena, arrives when they're in the midst of distributing the food. And she walks in and she asks them, is there anybody who can help me? And she begins to tell them their story, that she had just crossed the river. She didn't know anybody, but that she had a daughter in Los Angeles that needed her, and that she needed to make her way to Los Angeles. Is there any way that anyone could help her? This group of women that had this ministry responded to her, welcomed her, gave her a change of clothing so that she could get out of her wet clothing, and then invited her to join with them and share a meal. In the process, one of them called me and asked me, look, we have this woman that just arrived. She's from El Salvador. Would you guys be able to take her in? And we said, absolutely, that's what we do. They said, we'll bring her down. Fine. After they were done distributing the baskets, after they had done, finished eating their meal, they asked this woman, Morena, if she was ready, that they were going to take her to this house of hospitality. And one of the women who drove said, I'll drive you. Another one of the women said, I'll go with you. So the two women that were part of the group got in the front, Morena got in the back, and they drove out of the parking lot. They had to get on the freeway and travel 5 or 6 miles. They travel the freeway, they get off on the exit that's going to bring them to Annunciation House. When they get off the exit and are coming down one of the streets that will connect them to San Antonio Street, which is where we are, the woman that is driving, and you need to understand, these are elderly women that do this. She's driving, and she begins to realize, I am being followed. I am being followed. She continues to drive. She turns onto San Antonio Street, and sure enough, this unmarked pickup truck turns onto San Antonio Street. She drives down San Antonio, and Annunciation House is located where San Antonio and Olive Street make a Y, and our building is a triangular-shaped building, two-story brick building, that fits into that Y. The woman drives, and she makes a U-turn in the front of the point to go down the site to eventually get into the parking lot, when the pickup truck then accelerates, speeds up, passes her, and cuts her off in the front. And then another pickup truck pulls up behind them to block them off. And two immigration agents, ICE agents from the pickup truck in the front, get off and begin to approach. Two immigration ICE agents from the back get out of the truck and begin to approach the car. They've got their badges that they carry around their neck. And one of the agents approaches the woman that is driving and says, do you realize that what you are doing is illegal? Can I see your driver's license? So you can imagine how afraid and terrified these women were. They take out the driver's license. He asked for the driver's license of the other woman that was sitting in the front seat, and then turns to Morena in the back seat and says, I know you're illegal. Get out. You're under arrest. The agents from the pickup truck in the back are there by the door. As she gets up, they put handcuffs on her and they arrest her. The ICE agent from the front pickup goes back to his computer to run the driver's license of these two older women. After he runs the check and there's nothing on the computers, he comes back and he returns the driver's license to the two women and says to them, my boss said to return, my supervisor said to return your driver's license back to you and to let you proceed. One of the women asked, are we in trouble? Are we going to be arrested? And he said, no, you just need to understand that what you are doing is illegal. They got on their pickup trucks and they drove off and they took Morena. Okay. Part of the problem with immigration is that we have a very difficult time understanding the relationship between us and the immigrant, and that relationship is a historical relationship for us here in the United States. That relationship begins when we defined the border of the United States, and as we went through the process of defining the geographical territory of the United States. You're going to have to go back to 1848, when the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed after the war between the United States and Mexico. a war that resulted in the United States taking from Mexico what are now the states of California, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, Nevada. That treaty also established the boundary between the United States and Mexico to be the Rio Grande, and that was also the time at which Texas joined the Union. If you look at that treaty, there isn't a credible historian today that is going to say to you that that war was about anything other than the United States fulfilling its own vision of being a country that went from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. It just so happened that there was this chunk of land that was owned by Mexico that stood in the way. And so the process was to take it and make it part of the United States. And that is, in fact, what happened. A few years later, the land transition was completed through the Gaston Purchase that was settled in 1853, when the remaining piece of land was paid for to Mexico so that we could keep the territory intact. Shortly after the war with Mexico, the United States got caught internally in trying to resolve an issue that has many parallels to today as we look at immigration. And that issue was the Civil War, a process and an experience that took the lives of over 1 million of us. 1 million U.S. citizens died to settle one question. Is it going to be acceptable for us to own another human being? And I promise you, there was a lot of analysis and there was a lot of statistics. There was a lot of people that said, here are the economic benefits of slavery and here are the economic benefits of not having slavery. Today, we are all giving out all kinds of statistics about immigration, why we should or shouldn't do this about immigration. It was the same leading up to the Civil War. But in the end, the issue wasn't one of statistics and economics. It was about definition. And it took 1 million U.S. lives to say, we want to be defined as a people who categorically say one human being may not own another human being. After the Civil War, and the nation more or less settled down, we got busy with the business of beginning to develop the country. And that busyness included connecting the country from the East Coast to the West Coast, the railroad. It included beginning to do the mining of the resources of a very wealthy resource nation. It also included beginning to develop the agricultural lands of the United States, the agricultural industry. The desire to connect the railroad, to begin mining minerals and resources, to begin taking advantage of agriculture, required labor that we did not have, and so we saw the first appeal to immigrants to come into the U.S. to help in these three major industries. In fact, many people from China were brought in to help build the railroad from the east to the west part of the United States. They were here because we gave them the job of helping to build the railroad, and God only knows how many people from China lost their lives in the work of building that railroad. Come the beginning of the 1880s, we begin to see the first backlash. As the economy changes, as it goes up and down, there is now a backlash, and we see the passage by Congress of one of the very first immigration bills. It is known specifically as the Chinese Exclusion Act. That's what it was called. And as you might imagine, the purpose of that act was to find ways to kick the Chinese out of the country. We now didn't want them. When we needed them, we brought them in, help us build our railroad. When we were done with them, we then vilify them, and we proceed to want to kick them out. That is the pattern of our immigration history through the past 160 years, bringing people in, kicking them out. Shortly after the 1882 passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, we saw Congress then pass several more immigration acts that led up to 1891, when Congress passed an immigration act that created the Immigration Service. That Immigration Service was initially placed within the Treasury Department. And the reason Congress did that was because it viewed immigration not as a people control issue. It viewed it as an economic issue. And so it put it in Treasury because this had to do with the economic development of the United States. That law also authorized the first employment of immigration agents. And Congress, in its creation of the Immigration Service, instructed the Treasury Department to tell the Immigration Service that they were to be about the following work: to prescribe rules for inspection along the border of Canada, British Columbia, and Mexico so as not to obstruct or unnecessarily delay, impede, or annoy passengers in ordinary travel between these countries and the United States. Stop and listen. Congress told the Treasury Department that as it evolved the Immigration Service, that one of their jobs was to prescribe inspections that would not obstruct, unnecessarily delay, impede, or annoy passengers in ordinary travel between the United States. If you go to the border today, immigration obstructs, necessarily delays, impedes, and I can absolutely assure you, annoys everybody in the normal business of entering and exiting the United States. You have people tell you when they cross over, how long did it take? Today it took 3 hours. Some days it only took an hour, and people are really joyful that it only took an hour to cross over. Shortly thereafter, immigration proceeds to actually begin to hire the 180 agents for which Congress budgeted. And the distribution of those agents were that 119 of them were assigned to Ellis Island in New York to help with the processing of immigrants that were entering the United States through New York. 60 of them were distributed along the border in the north and in other places in the United States. On the United States-Mexico border, they made the decision that it was sufficient to assign one agent to patrol the entire U.S.-Mexico border. 6 years later, they came to the conclusion that one agent was probably not enough, so they increased it to four agents. Okay? In 1903, the Immigration Service was moved from the Treasury Department to Commerce and Labor. Again, indicative that Congress viewed immigration primarily in terms of economic terms, not in terms of people control. In 1907, the Immigration Service was instructed to look at the migration of people coming in through Mexico from other countries, people that were using Mexico to travel and come into the United States. And as a result of that study, the Immigration Service moved to define immigrants in terms of being legitimate or illegitimate immigrants. Illegitimate immigrants were people that came from Syria, from Japan, from Greece, Middle Eastern countries. Legitimate immigrants were those that came from Mexico. It was also at that time that the United States began to document arrivals through its borders, and it implemented an import fee to come into the United States, a fee that came to be known as a head tax. You need to understand that that only happened. Records of people entering the United States were only taken if you actually came in through a port of entry. You only paid the tax if you came in through a port of entry. If you didn't have the money, you simply came around the ports of entry. There was no border patrol. They didn't come chasing you. They didn't detain you. They didn't deport you. You just didn't pay the tax. It wasn't about trying to control people. It was about economics. Then comes World War I. Millions of people join the military and go off to do military service fighting the war in Europe. There was a shortage of labor in the United States. What did we do? We turned around to Mexico and said, bring in your people to help make up for the labor shortage. It was during this time that the Arizona Cotton Growers Association proceeded to spend $500,000 recruiting people from Mexico to come to Arizona to work in the cotton fields of Arizona. $500,000 in 1919 would be millions of dollars in today's dollars in 2011. And yet, that's what they did. They spent all that money to bring immigrants to work in the cotton agricultural industry of Arizona. What happens in 1929? The stock market crashes, and so we now go back the pendulum and we blame the immigrant for the stock market. You are responsible for the crash of the stock market, and so now start the deportation. You are the ones to blame. You are the bad guys in this. If it wasn't for you, and so out of the country, and so we deport them. When we need you, when World War I comes, come on in, come help us, work for us. Arizona pays to bring people in. When the economy gets difficult, get out of the country. You're the one that is at fault. And so you had these massive deportations. The Great Depression sets in. The 30s begin to come to an end. Hitler comes to power in Germany, and we enter World War II. 16 million U.S. residents and citizens in the armed forces of the United States fighting in different theaters, massive labor shortages. What do? Mexico, send in your people. We need you in agriculture. We need you in other areas. Send in your people. The Bracero program is established to systematically bring in large numbers of Mexicans to work in the United States. At that time, if you crossed the river, legally or not, if you went into an army recruiting station and said, I want to join the army, the recruiter would say, if you join the army, I will give you citizenship. If you come fight for us, I will give you citizenship. We need you that badly. World War II comes to an end. We started the transition from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy. Millions of soldiers are being discharged from the military. They're coming home. Guess what happens? Again, you have the backlash. Let's now start kicking the immigrant out. What are you doing here? We don't need you here. We don't want you. You're the one that's making things so difficult. Get out of the country. 1954, 1 million Mexicans are deported. Last year, under Obama, 400,000 immigrants were deported, and we did it with an awful lot of sophisticated people power and technology. You can imagine what deporting 1 million people in 1954 must have looked like, and in fact, we know that many U.S. citizens and residents got caught in those raids and were deported unconstitutionally. After World War II, we see the world divided between the Soviet sphere, the U.S. sphere, communism versus the democracies, or how we like to define ourselves as democracies. There begins to grow concern about the stability of Central and Caribbean nations, the poverty, and the concern that communism will take a foothold in these countries. And so we begin to do economic development in the hope of trying to give people work in these countries. We see the beginning, the introduction of twin plants, the beginning, the birth of maquiladoras, in an effort to put people to work, only later realizing that it was a way of also exploiting the cheap labor that was available to us in these poor countries. The backlash continues in 1986 with the passage of the Immigration Reform and Control Act by Congress that for the first time made it illegal for us to employ an undocumented person. In 1994, NAFTA is passed by Congress, and we are promised that with NAFTA will come the development that Mexico needs. It will create more jobs. It will keep people in Mexico. As a result of that, immigration will go down. It will be wonderful. We will all have work. We'll all be prosperous. We'll all hold hands around the Rio Grande, and we'll all sing Kumbaya and be at peace, you know. In fact, we learned it didn't work that way. And today the statistics are saying to us that the economy in Mexico has declined. The wage disparity between people in Mexico and the United States is even greater today than it was pre-NAFTA. And interestingly, at the same time that NAFTA was being introduced, you saw the beginning of special border control operations beginning in El Paso with what was initially called the border blockade and later changed to Operation Hold the Line, specifically aimed at stopping the flow of people across the border. Shortly thereafter, we saw a similar operation on the Tijuana, California border known as Operation Gatekeeper, which then led to pushing people to cross in through the United States through Arizona and the desert in Arizona, counting that the Arizona desert and heat would serve as a surrogate border patrol agent and stop people from crossing, because if they attempted to cross through the desert, they would cook, they would die in the desert. Last year, 2010, recorded a record number for bodies found in the desert in 1 year. In 1996, Congress passes the Illegal Immigration Reform and Responsibility Act, which brought into existence bars to legalization. You enter the country illegally, you stay in the country for 180 days plus one, you will now be barred from legalization for 3 years. You enter the country, you stay here illegally for 365 days plus one, you will be barred for 10 years from ever being able to legalize. You get caught, you enter the country, you get caught and deported, and you re-enter, you will be permanently barred from ever being able to legalize. I mention this because one of the things that you hear today is that why must people enter illegally? Why can't they do it the legal way? You don't do it the legal way is because it's almost impossible to do it the legal way. That 1996 law also said that people who do legalize are prohibited from getting any kind of public tax-supported assistance for 10 years. I've been at this for 33 years. I've seen thousands of people go through Annunciation House. I have yet to meet one person who is undocumented, who succeeded in applying for and receiving food stamps, welfare, or housing. I just haven't seen it. Perhaps someone somewhere in the country has. I just haven't seen it. What I'm saying to you is that It is next to impossible for people to receive social benefits if they are undocumented. It also increased the threshold for people that are sponsoring an immigrant to 125% of the poverty guideline. It means that I cannot be a sponsor of anybody attempting to legalize if my income is not at 125% above the poverty guideline for the number of people that are part of the family unit. In other words, making it economically much more difficult to be part of helping someone to immigrate into the United States. That law also limited the ability of immigration judges to do reviews of asylum. So people petitioning for asylum and were denied asylum, the review process is much more difficult. We're living with that right now. If you are from Mexico and you are directly affected by the violence that is happening in Mexico and you present yourself at the border and ask for asylum, within about 7 to 14 days, you are going to have what is called a credible fear interview. That interview is conducted by an asylum officer. If in the process of that interview, at the end of it, the asylum officer determines that you do not have a credible fear, you are then immediately removable, and you cannot appeal that. You are removed. So the 1996 law limited greatly the process of political asylum. This brings us to the myths that underlie a lot of the discussion that goes on in the immigration debate today. One of them is crime, that immigrants. I spoke today at Creighton Prep and had an opportunity to have some lengthier question and answer periods with some of the students. Many of their questions were related to crime. The belief that immigrants are a source of criminality in the United States. Between 1994 and 2005, the undocumented population of the United States doubled. It went from 6 to 12 million undocumented people. There are reasons for that, which we don't have the time to go into, but it doubled. One of the research institutes then went to the FBI and asked the FBI to do an analysis of crime in the country during that 10-year period. You need to understand that you cannot be arrested and booked for a crime anywhere in the United States, be it the largest metropolitan city or the smallest little town, without that statistic making its way into the FBI computers. The analysis of the FBI computers told us that between 1994 and 2005, when undocumented people in the United States doubled, during that same period, violent crimes went down 34% in the United States. Homicides went down 37%. Robberies went down 40%. Assaults went down 32%, and property crime went down 26%. The undocumented population doubled, and across the country, crime went down. Obviously, I'm not implying that because immigrants came in, crime went down. What I am implying is that contrary to the belief that undocumented people, that immigrants entering the country means crime goes up, the FBI statistics are not substantiating that anywhere near as being truth. Not satisfied with those statistics, the think tank went back and analyzed which states were the recipients of the largest influx of immigrants in that 10-year period, states like Texas, Florida, California, and they identified 19 states that are the recipients of the largest number of immigrants in that 10-year period, and they separated them from the other states. So you had two groups, 19 and 31. They asked the FBI, do your numbers again. The FBI comes back and says, in that 10-year period, Both groups saw a reduction of crime, but the greatest reduction of crime took place in the 19 states that were the recipients of the largest number of immigrants. El Paso, Texas, a city with 800,000 people, right on the border with Mexico, with an estimated 100,000 undocumented people. A year ago, when the FBI released its national statistics, where they rate the largest 100 metropolitan areas in the United States, said that after Honolulu, Hawaii, El Paso was the second safest city in the United States. I've been teasing with people that when I was invited to come here to Omaha, Nebraska, that one of the things that kept me from wanting to come to Omaha, Nebraska, was that I was concerned for my safety. I was going to leave the second safest city in the United States and come into the crime-infested neighborhoods of Omaha, Nebraska, and I wouldn't come unless I could be absolutely assured that I was going to be safe while I was here in Omaha, Nebraska. Immigrants don't pay taxes. The state comptroller of the state of Texas, Carol Keaton, a gubernatorial candidate who ran against Rick Perry in the 2008 governorship race, a conservative Republican woman. Her son, Scott McClellan, was George Bush's press secretary. He resigned to help manage his mom's campaign for the governorship. She was the comptroller of the state of Texas. Her office, under Carol Keaton, did the first ever analysis of the impact of undocumented people in the state of Texas. Carol Keaton found out that there were 1.5 million undocumented people living in the state of Texas. She said that if somehow you could magically wave a wand and pull out all 1.5 million people, that Texas would take $1.7 billion hit annually to its GDP. The Cato Institute recently said that if left alone, the undocumented population of the United States will add $1.5 trillion to the United States gross domestic product in the next 10 years. If you don't know who the Cato Institute is, it's one of the conservative think tanks in Washington. It's one of the entities that is often quoted by conservatives in regards to statistics. So they consider those statistics credible. That same Cato Institute said that if you could deport the 11 million people that are undocumented in the United States, the Cato Institute said the United States would take a $2.6 trillion hit to its gross domestic product. Okay? Carol Keaton's analysis, when she specifically compared what undocumented people in Texas pull out in state tax-supported services and compared that to what undocumented people put in the taxes, the state taxes that they pay into Texas, Carol Keaton said every year, Texas is a net gainer of $400 million over and above by the undocumented community in the taxes that they pay in. All of us work. We all get Social Security and Medicare deducted from our paychecks. That's the result of working what is called on the books. You use your Social Security number, and that's what we use to tie us into the IRS and Social Security Administration. There are many bogus Social Security numbers. These are numbers that people invent out of thin air. These are numbers that people get because they take somebody's wallet. These are numbers that people borrow. If you happen to have a small child who's 6 months old and someone asks you, can I use your child's Social Security number to work with? It could be that an elderly relative of you died and someone asks you for the Social Security number. And so you start working. You know, you can imagine the look of people at the Social Security Administration that all of a sudden they begin to receive the taxes, Social Security taxes, from someone who died 10 years ago and says, you know, Jesus isn't the only one that resurrected. There's quite a few people, you know, in different parts of the country that have resurrected as well. Okay? All of those stream of taxes that enter the Social Security Administration are tracked in what is known an earning suspension file. Social Security doesn't keep the money. It gets the money, it documents it, it turns it around and sends it right back in the form of Social Security checks. Okay? Up to now, the Social Security Administration has tracked $500 billion in its earning suspension file. The undocumented population of the United States has thus far contributed $500 billion to the Social Security Trust Fund. If there are some of you that are retired here that are receiving a Social Security check, when you go home today, you get on your knees and you say, thank you, God, for all those undocumented people that are helping my check come every month to me. Okay? In Texas, as is true in many states, we finance our public elementary, junior, and high schools through property taxes. What is one of the mantras that you hear over and over and over? Why do we have to educate the children of the undocumented? Why do we have to accept that burden? Let's look at that burden, okay? How do we pay for George Smith Elementary School or George Smith High School? How do we finance it? How do we build the school and pay the teachers? We do it through property taxes. We do it through the sale of lottery tickets. We do it through subsidies from our state government to try and equalize funding levels to keep school districts more or less equal in our states. Oftentimes, those taxes come to the states through things like sales tax. Take El Paso, Texas. Try and imagine this. I am Ruben, and I marry Maria, and Maria and I cross the river, and we cross over with our three children. We cross over. I get a job working on a construction crew. I have somebody's Social Security number. I'm working on a construction crew. My wife and I, we rent this apartment. My wife sells burritos. She cleans homes to add to the income. And so we're living in this apartment complex. Over there is Ruben and Mary, who are U.S. citizens. Ruben and Mary have college degrees. They also have three kids, and they have their three kids in school. Ruben and Mary are teachers. Ruben and Mary work for a computer company. Ruben and Mary work for a bank. Ruben and Mary have a job. They're buying a home, and they're paying a mortgage. In the state of Texas, there is something that is called a homestead exemption. It allows you to exempt a certain level of the value of your home, and so you pay homestead property taxes on your home. Ruben and Maria live in an apartment complex. That is considered a commercial piece of property, and they pay commercial property taxes on that apartment complex. The owner takes his taxes, divides it by the number of units that he has, and each unit pays that part of the property tax spread out in the monthly rent that is charged in a 12-month period. Ruben and Maria buy lottery tickets. We buy lottery tickets because economically we're on the margin, and we buy lottery tickets hoping that someday we might win the lottery. Ruben and Mary, they have college degrees. They took a class called statistics. They know that the odds of winning the lottery are so small that it makes more sense to simply take that money, put it in a mutual fund, and just keep feeding it, and 30 years, 40 years later, it's going to be a couple thousand dollars. Ruben and Maria can't even pronounce the word statistic. When Mary and Ruben go to Kmart or Target or Macy's, when they go to Sam's, Costco and they buy something, they pay sales tax. When Reuben and Mary go to a gas station and they fill up their car with gasoline, they pay both the federal gasoline tax and the state gasoline tax. When Reuben and Maria go to Target and buy something, when they get to the cashier, they say to the cashier, oh, you know what? We're undocumented. We're here illegally, so please deduct the sales tax. You know, you see it all the time. The one that I really like is when Reuben and Maria go fill up their car with gasoline. You might, next time you fill up your car with gasoline, hang around the gas station. Just stand by one side and just observe. Eventually, you're going to see an undocumented person come fill up their car and watch what happens. They get out of the car, they open up their gas tank, and then they look around to see if anybody's watching. And when they think nobody's watching, they go up to the gasoline pump and they whisper in the side, I'm undocumented, deduct the taxes. And then the gas pump recalculates, and so they pay 40, 50 cents less per gallon of gasoline than you do. If you really watch closely, you'll hear and see how they do it, so that then you too, next time you fill up, you go up to the pump and say, you know what, I'm an undocumented person, you know, which would be a real change. I'm trying to pass off as an undocumented person. That's a switch, isn't it? Okay? All I'm saying to you, that it is almost impossible to live in the United States and not pay the majority of the same taxes that all of us pay. The last time Congress attempted immigration reform, and a version of immigration reform actually passed the House of Representatives, known as the STRIVE Act, one of the provisions that was included in allowing the undocumented population to legalize was a requirement that everyone who applied for legalization would be obligated to sign a renunciation of ever making a claim on any of the Social Security taxes they had paid during the entire time that they had been working here as undocumented people. Isn't that an interesting provision to put into an immigration bill when we keep insisting they don't pay taxes? The National Research Council tells us that the average immigrant in the United States pays $1,800 a year over and above what they take out in tax-supported services. They say that when you add the tax pay of the children of immigrants throughout a lifetime, it actually becomes an $80,000 contribution over and above what is pulled out in tax-supported services. During President Bush's term, every year, President provides Congress with a report on the state of the country. It includes an analysis of demographic. President Bush's analysis to Congress said that between 2015 and 2020, when you look at the worker population growth in the United States, during that period of time, workers that are 55 years of age and older, that part of the workforce is going to increase by 50%. The workforce between the ages of 25 and 54 is going to increase by 5.1%. Workers between the ages of 16 and 24 is going to increase by 9%. What we're learning is we're getting older, and the number of younger people coming through the pipeline ain't very big. Social Security Administration tells us that in 1950, for every person that was retired, if I was retired in 1950, there were 18 workers paying into the Social Security system so that I could get my retirement check. Okay? In other words, 18 people were holding me up in retirement. By 1960, That dropped to 9. There were now 9 workers holding up every retiree. By 2010, last year, that had dropped to 3.5 workers for every retiree. By 2020, it is going to be 2.2 workers. Okay? I'd be concerned for those of you here at Creighton University what that's going to look like when it comes time for you to retire. Okay? Perhaps more significant, in 1960, the birth rate in Mexico was 6.2 babies for every woman. Last year, 2010, the birth rate in Mexico was down to 2.2 per woman. Mexico will very shortly have a birth rate comparable to that of the United States. We are yelling, let's get rid of all of these undocumented people without stopping to realize the day's going to come, there ain't going to be any undocumented people to come into our country. They're simply not having the births. People having fewer births is an issue in Japan. It is an issue in Russia. It is an issue in European countries to the point that governments are now giving couples bonuses to have babies. The economic viability of countries as they know themselves to be are now an issue. There are countless statistics. There are countless studies. I would encourage all of you to go into the Immigration Policy Center's website. They themselves do not do any of the research. The Immigration Policy Center is one of the arms of AILA, the American Immigration Lawyers Association. They're the ones that fund the Immigration Policy Center. They dedicate themselves to scouring the entire country and keeping tabs on all of the research that is being done by universities and think tanks across the country. And so they make it their job to find those studies and then bring them to the public arena. It's an excellent source of documentation on the immigration issue, and I would encourage you to go in. I want to end by sharing with you what I think the real central question for us is. And I'm going to share with you a passage from the Gospel of Luke. And now a lawyer stood up and to test him asked, "Master, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus then asked him, "What is written in the law? What is your reading of it?" The lawyer replied, "You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." Jesus then said to him, "You've answered right. Do this, life is yours." But the man was anxious to justify himself and said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Okay? In answer, Jesus said, "A man was one on his way down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of bandits. They stripped him, beat him, and left him, leaving him half dead. Now a priest happened to be traveling down the same road, but when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. In the same way, a Levite who came to the place saw him and passed on by on the other side. But a Samaritan traveler who came upon him was moved with compassion when he saw him. He went up to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. He then lifted him onto his own mount and took him to an inn and looked after him. Next day, he took out 2 denarii and handed them to the innkeeper and said, 'Look after him, and on my way back, I will make good any extra expense you have.' Which of these 3 proved himself a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the bandits?" The lawyer replied, "The one who showed pity toward him." Jesus then said to him, "Go and do the same yourself." We have all heard that parable. I mean, the Good Samaritan, we've heard it. Most of us have heard it, and it's been explained to us that this is about how some of us can be uncaring and how we should all be like the Samaritan and care for our brother or sister in need. But there's an aspect to this parable that is particularly pertinent to the immigration issue. That priest and that Levite didn't pass by because they were uncaring. They passed by because in the Jewish faith, if you were a priest, you were prohibited from touching a dead body. If you were a Levite, you were part of the priestly tribe within the Jewish tradition, you were prohibited from touching or handling a dead body. When they walked by and saw this guy half dead, they didn't do it because the law prohibited them from touching a dead body. So they wanted to comply with the law and walked on. Interesting that the person who engages Jesus is of all people a lawyer who is an expert in Jewish law, and he wants to see if he can trap Jesus. And in the end, knowing that the priest and the Levite had passed by so that they could remain in compliance with the law, and Jesus asks the lawyer, "Who's the neighbor?" And the lawyer ends up saying, "The Samaritan." How many times have we not heard that this is about people who broke the law and they do not want to get away from that central point? They broke the law. They broke the law. If that's what it's about, I'm saying to you, you decide. Are you that priest? Are you a member of the Levite? Or do you choose to be a Samaritan? Thank you so much for your time, for your presence, for being here. Okay?
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ruben Garcia, founder and executive director of Annunciation House on the El Paso-Juarez border. He spoke on the topic, Welcoming the Stranger, Immigrant Hospitality at the Border and Creighton. Mr. Garcia's talk was co-sponsored by several Creighton University areas and organizations, including the School of Law, the College of Business, the Graff Faculty Chair in Catholic Theological Studies, Campus Ministry, the Cortina Community, and the Creighton Center for Service and Justice. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, February 10th, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.